Hi, I'm Mal Majoros. I am an 8-year cancer survivor. My blog, The Cancer Warrior, is one of the top 10 breast cancer blogs, according to blogs.com. I'm here to bring a fresh, upbeat perspective to a topic that to some may seem scary. A positive mental attitude got me through my cancer, and I hope to share that with you. Talking to lung cancer survivor Amanda Corey. I believe we met at Hope Summit, like we were talking before the show, correct?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay, yeah. Like I said, chemo brain, and there's so many great people that I've met at Hope Summit. It's just sometimes it's all a big, amazing blur.
In the best way.
Totally, in the best way. So we were talking a little bit about you beforehand, but you were diagnosed 2 years ago, and you're pretty young, so let's just dive right into your story.
Absolutely. So I just had my birthday, so I just turned 26 years old, which means I was 24 when I was diagnosed.
Wow.
I had been feeling really ill for many years, like many people who I've talked to at the Hope Summit and I've come across in my travels and asking. I was diagnosed with asthma, with pneumonia, with bronchitis. I had a million inhalers. I was always having some sort of sickness. But other than that, I actually lived a really active life. And it wasn't until I kind of started to diminish my activity and not dance as much and not work out as much that I got increasingly more sick. And so the summer leading up to my diagnosis, I had a terrible, terrible cough that wouldn't go away. And I had a wheeze that everyone in my office would make fun of me for because I sounded like a grandpa. And one day, it was very funny. We learned very quickly it wasn't so funny.
Yeah.
But I was in the office one day and I was particularly not feeling well. And I kind of lost my voice really suddenly. And I thought I had laryngitis. Turns out I just couldn't breathe.
Oh.
And so I went to a minute clinic, like an outpatient emergency room. And I walked in and I was like, hi, you know, I'm 24. I work in New York City. I have a chest tightness and shortness of breath. So you can't say those two things. I was immediately rushed into a room and given an EKG because they thought I was having a heart attack.
Right. And just to stop you, if you're ever in the emergency room or something and you're worried about something, those are the key words to say, even if you're not.
Of course. Yes. Quickly, that's what you say.
Exactly.
Yes, I was immediately rushed ahead, a very crowded room in New York City, to be the first seen for anything. And thankfully, the nurse actually read my report incorrectly and diagnosed me as having a heart attack.
Oh.
And, you know, out comes the ambulance, and I am a New Yorker, and I was like, oh, I'm not going to take an ambulance when the hospital is two blocks in an avenue. I'm going to walk. So I walked, and I called my mom, and I was like, hey, heads up. It's not this, but I have to go. I walked in, was immediately given a CT scan, and little did I know that I would walk out of that hospital with one less organ and a life-changing diagnosis.
Oh.
And so I spent 2 weeks in the hospital. I was actually almost discharged once because everyone thought I was fine and just healing from pneumonia. And it wasn't until a pulmonologist did a bronchoscopy and found a tumor in my right lung. And she was like, oh, that's really not good. I was really lucky. So I had a neuroendocrine tumor, which is a little different than a lot of other lung cancers.
Mm-hmm.
Per se, I didn't have lung cancer. I had cancer in my lung, which is a more technical delineation. But regardless, the tumor was very large and in a kind of not wonderful place that my entire lung had to be taken.
None of the other doctors did any kind of scans when you were coughing and stuff? That's weird.
Nothing. I did have a couple x-rays, but as I've learned, it's very difficult to find any sort of mass on an x-ray. I never was given a CT scan. And, you know, I think, you know, that's why I do a lot of speaking because, you know, if somebody had just asked the scary question, which is kind of what a lot of my speaking is based around, you know, ask the scary question, is this lung cancer?
Right.
You know, perhaps I could have saved my lung and we could have found it and it would have been a little bit of a less invasive surgery. But, you know, that being said, I have one lung now, my left lung. Her name is Betsy. She's wonderful. I forget most days that I have one lung, but I never forget about what I went through. And so, you know, I spend a lot of my time making sure that other young people around understand, you know, that you don't have to be, you know, a really old grandpa like they show in the commercials.
Right.
Smoked 70 years and that's why they have lung cancer. So, you know, I'm really trying to make an effort to educate people that if you have lungs, you can get lung cancer.
Now, how many people have asked you the question that all lung cancers really just want to smack the person across the face?
I know. I mean, the question, did you smoke?
Yes.
I would say 1 in 3 people.
Ugh.
And, you know, my response, because I'm a little sassy, as I'm sure you can tell.
You are? What?
Usually, oh, yes. I'm usually like, oh, yes, I smoked 5 packs a day since I was 5 years old. You know, and I usually take that moment, as I think most advocates do, to educate and say, you know, even if somebody did smoke, does that mean they deserve to have a terrible disease? And that usually right. stops that question quickly. But that being said, no, I did not smoke. I do have friends that did, and my diagnosis very quickly made them all quit, which I think is great.
Well, yeah, but, I wasn't asking you, yeah. When we go to the Hope Summit, it's like, that's the one question, and it's just like...
The one question. That's the deadly question.
Yeah. And of course, you know, that as we're trying to reduce the stigma, you would never ask somebody with throat cancer, well, did you, you know, you know.
Of course. And you would never ask somebody whose parents are dying of heart disease, well, did they eat a lot of hamburgers?
Yeah.
Like... it's just not the way that should be ever approached.
That's kind of funny, but not really. Yeah. Did your mom and dad eat a lot of mayonnaise wrapped in bacon or what?
Right. Yeah. You would never ask that. That
no.
would be just ludicrous. So why would you ask somebody who has a very serious disease if they smoked and that's why they got it?
Yeah. I was even talking, there's a bike ride for breast cancer that I'm involved with. And we were even talking on the other radio show that I work on about lung cancer. And it's like, yeah, you don't ask. You know, if you have lungs, you can get lung cancer. You don't ask somebody, did you smoke or any other, you know, and you don't say, oh yeah, my Aunt Susie had lung cancer. She died. Are you going to die? I had somebody ask me that. I'm like, yeah. I'm not planning on it right now. Not at this moment.
Oh my gosh, my favorite was I had somebody say, well, I've done a lot of research and I hear it's by environmental factors. So it must have been because you live in New York City. And I was like, well, I grew up in North Carolina in a very rural place. So thank you for being concerned. But if that's the truth, then we have a lot more lung cancer in New York City than we even know.
Exactly. That's weird.
Lots of educated people.
Yeah, you're like, oh, yes, please find out all the information you need to find out on Facebook, because that's good.
Exactly.
So your lung is named what?
Betsy.
Betsy.
Her name is Betsy.
Did you name the other lung that you took out?
I didn't actually. And you know, one of my coping methods has always been kind of making light of situations.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was healing and everything, I was very upset for a very long time that they wouldn't let me keep my lung, like so that I could have it on display or something, like
oh.
a trophy.
Well, why not? It's yours.
That's what I was saying. It is mine. But thankfully, it was donated to research so that we could kind of figure out, you know, what happened and why. My lung actually had deflated for quite a bit of time.
Oh.
And we can't tell if that was from the tumor or what that was from. But it was a fun little gag we always had about me wanting to keep my lung in a jar.
Because, I mean, you could have made a great art project with that. I mean, and think of all
That's what I was saying.
You know.
I know. But that's okay.
All the galleries in New York City that you could have had that lung up in?
I know. It would have been great. All right. Well, you know, what a missed opportunity.
I know. Well, we can't say next time because then, you know.
Oh, yeah. That would be not ideal. We're hoping that won't happen.
It won't happen. So, Betsy, your lung is named Betsy, and let's go from there. Did you have any treatment, or just they removed the lung and then that was it?
I did. I just had a removal of the lung. I didn't have to have any treatment.
Oh, that's cool.
I did have pretty close together CT scans and doctor's appointments for a year,
mm-hmm.
just because I had what's called the carcinoid tumor. It's very under-researched, scarily under-researched. It's also really, really rare. I was the first, and I might be incorrect, but I was told that I was the first female operated on with a carcinoid in the New York area.
Oh.
So it was very rare. It's a really slow-growing tumor, so it probably was in there for about 6 years and just missed.
Oh.
So basically, it's just a very bizarre tumor that's not necessarily malignant, but it's really dangerous because they grow back. So if you don't get a big enough margin, that tumor will grow back. And like I said, it's not super researched, so that's kind of what we're guessing with it. And they also grow quite a bit in the brain and in the gut. So I had to be scanned for my intestines and for my brain. Thankfully, I didn't have any sort of radiation or really CT scans. We just kind of monitored for that. And I actually received my 100% clean bill of health in March of this year.
Oh, yeah.
So it was a lovely celebration.
That's kind of scary that it could just move. Well, yes, congratulations, but it could move
it's
to your
totally
brain.
It's scary, yeah. You know, and if you do research on them, it's really, there's not much. And, you know, I have a blog that I write in called mm-hmm. The One Lung Diary. I just started it, and I kind of talk about a little bit about a carcinoid. You know, I did research on it. I wanted to learn more about it. I wanted to be as informed as I could be,
right.
And I found nothing. And actually, that search and that goal was what brought me to longevity. And, you know, I chose to be a lung cancer advocate. I could have been a carcinoid tumor advocate. I could have been a young adult survivor advocate. You know, I chose lung cancer mm-hmm. because I couldn't believe that it's so underfunded and so under-researched from a purely scientific place, other than, you know, it just needs a lot more support. So, you know, it was actually that kind of trajectory that brought me to where I am today and to be the advocate I am today.
That's awesome. Well,
yeah.
But you must be looking at, as far as even being just the lung cancer advocate, looking on your own about the carcinoid tumors, because
that's kind of
I mean, I don't want to say bizarre, but that's astounding that you're the only female in New York City to have this and being so young.
Like I said, but that's what I was told. It's really common in men and it's common in younger boys. But something that's kind of cool is actually from the Hope Summit. I was talking with one of the, I'm going to get his title wrong, but he works for Novartis, for the pharmaceutical company. And I believe he works as a kind of a patient advocate, a patient rep.
Mm-hmm.
And they're developing a couple of treatment methods for carcinoids.
Oh, awesome.
So I had this amazing opportunity to go and speak for a bunch of nurses and members of the team at Novartis because I was one of the first survivors that they had ever found.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was really great because, you know, these people spend all day researching and putting together, you know, new methods and trying things out and lots of trial and error. And to have, you know, a human stand up in front of you and say, hi, you're doing this so that, you know, you can save my life or my organ or, you know, what may come next for other people with this syndrome. So it's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. Now, it must have been great to see the researchers and scientists, because a lot of times you think of, obviously, these people are like in their cubicles or in their rooms and just in their white coats and everything. And finally, to put a face to that must have been. Now, were you the only one that they've ever come across? I mean, probably the youngest for sure.
I was definitely the youngest. I don't believe I was the only one, but I was one of the few who had kind of a happy story in that, you know, and I believe that I truly believe that the universe gifted me what I got mm-hmm. so that I can live a very long life and talk about this for a very long time to a lot of different people. But I believe it was nice to have somebody who was quote unquote cured.
Right.
Because, you know, that's why you do it. You want the outcome to be a manageable disease, whatever the disease may be. So yeah, I definitely think it was great. And something also funny about me is my parents are both cancer researchers.
Oh.
So they also had a significant amount of insight, but also were very interested with what happened to me from a purely scientific world, because it is so underfunded and so strange and odd.
Are they lung cancer researchers or just in general?
Well, what's kind of exciting is my dad has always worked with a bunch of different pharmaceutical companies.
Mm-hmm.
But since my diagnosis, he has kind of taken a liking to lung cancer, which is really exciting. And so, you know, we can never have too little people focusing and researching. So he is now working on a couple companies. He does mostly startups and more entrepreneur, so more the business side of medical now. But one of his companies focuses on lung cancer, which I think is really great.
That is great.
And really what we need.
That must be kind of interesting, having your parents be cancer researchers. I could feel you kind of being under the microscope for a little bit while you were being diagnosed and everything.
I mean, I feel so lucky.
Well, yes.
That's also why I do what I do, because I had two people standing there who know everything that doctor is saying.
Right.
And who can relay that to me in not layman's terms, because that's not what we need, but in terms that matter of like, this is what this will feel like. This is what this is why this takes this time. And I can't imagine what it is like for somebody who doesn't have not one, but two people standing right next to them who have your best interest at heart and can, you know, really listen and give proper information. Yeah. Very lucky.
Talking at the Hope Summit, and when you do your speeches, your advocacy, you must come across a lot of lung cancer survivors who don't have that kind of person with them. I mean, they'll always have their caregivers or their, you know, have somebody with them, their friend. But, you know, when you start talking about, you know, all these medical terminology that you just see in like the TV TV shows, well, you're just like, what the hell are you talking about? You know,
what does that mean? Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like the word like clinical trial is so scary, and it's actually incredible, you know, and it's really wonderful that you have qualified for a clinical trial. And, you know, it might be scary to look at a contract before you receive treatment, but, you know, this is why we have to do it. And, you know, actually, that's why I'm really excited about the Cancer Moonshot Initiative.
Right.
Because, you know, half of what they're talking about is making sure that patients have access to all the data in order to make their own informed decision. And, you know, I feel very lucky that I was able to have parents to help me make that decision. But, you know, that's a huge part of advocacy, is making sure that people who are either newly diagnosed or in remission or have been fighting this for 10 plus years, treatments change every 6 months. You know, we have new advances every 6 months. It's really important to stay educated and on top of it. And even though it's scary to look at the facts and the numbers, I mean, there's just some amazing things that are available to try if you're willing to do a little bit of the research. But, you know, it's got to be easier and more attainable to everyone.
Right. And I think for me, I always thought of clinical trials as the last resort for people, which is not the case for some people.
Not at all. No. And, you know, it's, I think, and I could be incorrect, I'm not a scientist or a researcher, but, you know, I've heard a lot of talk about line of defense. Mm-hmm. What's your first line of defense, your second line of defense? And those don't mean options that run out. Those just mean, what do we think and has been proven to work the quickest for this circumstance?
Oh,
you know,
okay.
That doesn't mean that once we reach our third line of defense, that doesn't have any promise. It just means we have a little bit less research that this works on this.
Right. Because everyone, I mean, the thing is that it's hard to, when you're faced with a cancer diagnosis or if you have cancer, realize that everybody is different. So, you know, while you, Amanda, may have just had your lung removed and that was it, someone else who has something similar may have to have chemo or radiation or some other something else. And I think that's very difficult for a lot of survivors to deal with, I think, because, you know, surgery, radiation, and chemo, and other people are like, well, I didn't need this, that, and the other thing. And you're like, well, why is that? And then you realize, oh, well, you know, two people could have the exact same. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. Everyone has a different genetics. So
Exactly.
And you don't really think about genetics when you think about cancer. And you know, as you know, that's kind of exploding now, thank goodness. Finally.
Oh, I love genetic testing. I mean, I think it should be malpractice if a doctor does not genetically test your tumor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the fact that we understand now, you know, and this is getting very sciencey, but, you know, the basis of it is that, you know, each tumor has its own special, you know, lock and key. And if you can target what's going to destroy that tumor, that's how you beat this thing. And, you know, not beat in the way of like, I'm cured, but beat in the way of you get to live a really long life.
Right.
And yes, you have cancer, but that's not, hey, I know what's going to, you know, kill me. It's like, hey, I have cancer, but I'm still able to do everything that I want to be able to do. And I think that's why it's so important to know what your special little key code is of your tumor.
That's true. Critical. That's true. And when I was diagnosed in 2007, that's when the BRCA gene just started coming in. And that I think that the myriad, that whole lawsuit and everything, I think genetic testing seemed to be just on the forefront. I'm not sure about other cancers as far as breast cancer, but now, you know, like you said, hopefully some point in the future, you could just get a scan or take a pill or something and know, okay, well, I'm predisposed to this and this medication will help me here.
That's what we want with that liquid biopsy.
Oh,
you know,
exactly.
It's all about that early detection, and it's all about, you know, making sure that we know as much as humanly possible about your specific cancer. You know, it's kind of like a snowflake.
That's true. I like that. I like that idea.
Yeah.
It's like you've talked before. I'm just saying.
Yeah, exactly.
So you literally just started your blog. Look at that.
I did. Yeah. I just started. So like I said, you know, I've been about 2 years since my diagnosis. My first year, I really wanted to heal and kind of remind myself, you know, that because because something bad happened to me did not mean that I did something bad. You know, karma is real, but
right.
it's not that real. And, you know, I really wanted to make sure that, you know, I ran into some anxiety problems, mm-hmm. nothing health related, but a lot of anxiety related to people touching my back. I have a 13-inch scar on my back.
Oh.
And, you know, it kind of translated into, you know, me not wanting to take the subway, me not wanting to do this, that, and the other. So I really spent a year kind of healing myself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, before I turned 26, you know, I kind of sat down and I was like, what do I, you know, care about the most? You know, you're kind of an adult now, kind of.
We're all kind of adults.
You're making your way to adulthood. You know, what do you care about? And mm-hmm. Advocacy is just so high up on my list with, you know, my real career. And it's something that really can be done while you do other things.
Yes.
And I figured the best way to do that would be, you know, to just put my thoughts down on a blog and, you know, try and explain from a young perspective why this matters. You know, I have a really unique opportunity to have a really interesting subset of people look at my materials.
And I think
I want to empower, you know, those young people to be their own advocates and take control of their health.
Especially since you said you weren't feeling well for a while, and you know, like,
oh yeah,
a lot of, you know, I think a lot of people do get the sniffles and the asthma, and they might. I mean, I think if something goes on for that long of a time, you either ask your doctor for more tests. I mean, you know, you and I as an advocate,
exactly.
that's easy for us to say, but probably a little more difficult for the average person. But if that doctor doesn't say okay or listen to you, then I always advocate to get, you know, find another doctor, because they in fact work for you, not the other way around. And I know people,
exactly.
well, I don't want to hurt their feelings. It's like, look. Yeah, like even someone here, they're like,
feelings don't matter in health. They really don't.
Exactly.
Feelings are not part of this.
Well, I mean, you know, you're going to be worried about your breathing when you go home over the weekend. Course. That guy is going to be doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if he's a good doctor, obviously
exactly.
he cares about his patient, but you're probably not going to be as important as his family. So,
yeah, exactly.
Know.
And I mean, it's really scary to be like, I don't feel like that's the right diagnosis because I feel sicker than that.
Right.
And I think that's what people are afraid to do. You know, it's like, listen, if you feel sicker than what your doctor is telling you, then go talk to somebody else and fix it. You know, like
exactly.
feel better.
Exactly.
That's what matters.
Yeah, because that doctor isn't going to be upset. Oh, I was wrong. And now you have, you know, what's the worst thing to me? You went to a different doctor and they found something, you know, either nothing is wrong with you or something else. I mean, is that doctor going to feel bad because... You know, they found out
exactly.
you had lung cancer? No. And who cares if they do?
No.
Because that was the wrong person for you.
Exactly. Yeah. I actually had one of our, the pulmonologists that diagnosed me with pneumonia when I first got to the hospital came and apologized for not for my tumor earlier. So, I mean, it's definitely, you know, I had a second opinion and thankfully
right.
I did, or else I would have been sent home. And, you know, not to get sad or anything, but I might not be able to sit here and tell my amazing story because,
exactly.
you know, I had a completely collapsed lung and something very big in the way of helping me breathe. You know, so it's definitely worth making sure that whoever is seeing you is giving you advice that makes you feel, you know, safe and correct and
mm-hmm.
you're making the right choices.
Now, that's definitely for sure. Do you find a lot of young adult lung cancer survivors out there
of your age?
I've
found so many.
Oh,
yes.
Okay.
I mean, it's many more than I think people would assume.
Mm-hmm.
We have a great group, if anyone out there would like to join, called Young Adult Survivors, and it's for lung cancer specifically. And, you know, we talk about issues that...
Is that on Facebook or Google Plus?
It's on Facebook.
Okay.
Yeah, it's on Facebook. And that pertains specifically to, you know, some questions that really matter for our age group and,
mm-hmm.
and things that we think about. But it's amazing how many people, I would say, under 35...
Right.
have lung cancer, and there's some really amazing stories out there. And, you know, we're all at different stages of our lung cancer, but just because you're below 35 does not mean that your, you know, cancer is any in an earlier stage or any easier.
Right.
It's pretty insane.
Well, I imagine someone as young as you getting cancer, I'm sure a lot of doctors think, well, you're too young. I've heard this. Oh, it's, you're too young to have lung cancer. It's not that. It's like, well, like you said, oh, I have lungs. It could be lung cancer. You know, I have breast. It's breast cancer. You know, I mean, that's.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's another thing. Changing not only the stigma of society, but changing the minds of the doctors. We have a lot. We have a lot to work on, girl. I'm telling you.
We do. We have so much. But I also think, though, that's not just a lung cancer problem.
No.
I think there's a lot of cancers that, you know, you assume that some, if somebody is in 18 to 25 and they have cancer, it's going to be leukemia or it's going to be, you know, a cancer that in the past has affected children and young adults. But through just speaking with others and, you know, now I hear the word cancer and my ears immediately perk up and I feel like I listen to everyone's conversations.
Yes.
But, you know, I have met 24-year-olds who have had double mastectomies because they had breast cancer. I have met 18-year-olds who had stage 3 ovarian cancer. You know, there's a lot of cancers that you don't think young people get, and it's just so prevalent. And I don't know if it's that it wasn't talked about before, and we're just able, you know, now with social media to really, you know, be involved in everyone's lives,
right?
Or if it's a situation, you know, that that cancer really does affect everyone and that needs to be talked about.
Well, I don't think being someone who's never had cancer, you don't really listen for it. Whereas like you and I, like you say, you hear someone say cancer or, you know, someone who like me, who's gone through chemo, I can like go into a store and kind of like if somebody has, you know, has, I hate to say the chemo look, but the look about them that they've taken the medication, you know, you can just tell, like, you want to go up to them and say, I know what you're going through. But then again, it's just like, well, that's weird because they're a stranger. But, you know, at the same time, that's the kind of thing, like you say, your ears perk up like Scooby-Doo, like, what? Like, how can I help?
Yes. And, you know, I'm always the first person to be like, you know, if anyone, usually when I tell my story, somebody will always come to me and my grandfather, my mom, my sister, my uncle, this friend, you know, passed away from lung cancer. And, you know, the first thing I say is not, I'm sorry. The first thing I say is like, well, have you thought about being involved in the Breathe Deep NYC walk? Or have you thought about, you know, raising funds for this person? Or do you need to speak to somebody? You know, caregivers feel the effects of a disease just as hard as the person going through it. And, you know, I think that's also changing that conversation, you know, making it not, oh, I'm so sorry. That's so terrible. It's, well, what have you done to help this? You know,
exactly.
Like, we need you as an ally.
It's true. And a lot of, as you probably met caregivers at the Longevity Hope Summit, I feel that finally now caregivers are getting that, oh yeah, you know, they need help too during all this. Because when I was going through cancer, even 2007, it just seemed like, okay, there wasn't anything for my fiance to like call somebody and say, okay, I have to be strong for her, but I'm freaking the hell out, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really hard. And, you know, I have a dear friend who I've been friends with since childhood, whose father is going through a pretty outrageous brain cancer. And, you know, we talk all the time. And even though it's totally different and I know really nothing about what she and her father are going to, she was like, it's just so nice to be able to talk to somebody about it.
Who gets
it? Who is going to just sit there and listen, you know, because that's really what matters. And I wish all caregivers had like a service too, where they could just talk about what they're going through and just have somebody listen to them. You know, it's really important.
Exactly.
Really important.
I see. Look at all the things we have to work on, girl. I'm telling you.
Yeah, we have so much. Oh my gosh. It's a full-time job just worrying about this. Just kidding.
It is a full-time job. And just like that, our half hour is over. Now, I know that you have your blog, but did you say you're going to be doing the Breathe Deep in New York City?
I do. I have Amanda's Army. We walk every year. Well, we walked the last 2 years, but we kind of do it a little different. I spoke at the walk last year, which was really wonderful.
Nice.
I was our keynote speaker, and I would, you know, it was just a wonderful experience. And I had over 80 people on my team, which was pretty amazing. And we raised over $5,000, which was also pretty amazing.
That is amazing.
But we do that every year, and that's Amanda's Army. And I'll do a ton of press about that as well. And then other than that, I definitely am a full supporter of all of the longevity events. I think it's a wonderful organization.
Oh, yes.
As well as, you know, all of the smaller organizations that are going out there and fighting the good fight.
And you're... what is the name of your blog and how do people find it?
Yeah, so my blog is onelungdiary.wordpress.com. It's new, so I promise one day it'll be just a .com. But that's onelungdiary.wordpress.com. And so far I have up kind of a little bit more about my story, a little more about why you should care about lung cancer. Mm-hmm. And I actually just published a post about the Cancer Moonshot Initiative.
Yes.
And tried to kind of take a look at it and you know, chat a little more about why it's really exciting and why we should all be really excited about it. And then I'm going to do posts in the future about, you know, my scar and about healing, about my young survivors who are having kids and how that affects them, and kind of, you know, talk about some of the things about being a young adult survivor of cancer that don't get talked about a lot.
Oh, is that all you're doing?
That's just a little thing.
Just a little tip of the iceberg, just a little bit.
Well, passion project.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I know we had some, you know, tag your ex scenarios going on, but
well,
it finally.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Amanda. If you hang on, I'm going to wrap up like I usually do. This is Mel Majoros. I am the Cancer Warrior. You can always find me on Facebook because I am a Facebook junkie. Check out my blog, thecancerwarrior.blogspot.com. And as always, life looks pretty good from where I'm sitting. Sending you good vibes. It's a Cancer Warrior on EmpowerRadio.com.